Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Dermatilla Diaries. Today, I have with me a very special guest who is the author of Forever Marked, a Dermatilla Mania Diary, creator of the documentary Scars of Shame, and the owner and founder of skinpickandsupport.com, Angela Hartland. Thank you so much for joining me today, Angela.
Hi, Kim. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's amazing to finally speak to you. I would say face to face. It's still obviously over Zoom, but you were one of the first people that I came across online when I first had my diagnosis of dermatilla mania, and finally, understanding what I had was more than just a habit. So it's really nice to chat with you today. It means a lot to me personally.
Oh, wow. That's great. I'm really happy to hear that. It doesn't seem like anymore that I'm really the first person for a lot of people, because now that there's so much awareness, it's really amazing. Like, but years ago, like 10 years ago, it was like a totally different world. There was only a few people. And now there's so many Instagram accounts that I feed off of for my inspiration and ideas, and know how to push myself because I see everybody else pushing themselves. And it's a real comfort to know that really I've never been alone in this struggle, and that so many people have it. Whereas when I came out, I was the first one. So I didn't know how many people in the world actually had this. And it's been really refreshing to just see so many people being open about it and being able to talk about it. And it really still helps me to see that.
Absolutely. And that obviously took so much guts on your behalf to come out and be that first person to openly discuss it and, you know, give that support to other people, you know, potentially strangers you've never met online, by using yourself as a case study. So what pushed you to become that person that other people could look to for, you know, inspiration with their dermatilla mania?
I guess my intent wasn't really for people to look to me for inspiration, but I felt like I was at a point in my life where I had hid this for so long, like throughout junior high school, throughout high school, throughout university. And it really, really took a toll on my mental health. And I had a few breakdowns from the time that I was 17. And I realized that it was the shame behind my picking that was causing me so much anguish and thoughts of ending my life. And I wasn't able to control my skin picking, but I could control the way that I viewed it. And I got to a point too, really, like, hadn't dated for a long time and was starting to get into that again, because I really, really wanted to, I really wanted to be me, and I didn't want to hide anymore. And I had been alone for so long that I was like, you know what, if anybody knows and anybody judges me, they can judge me flat out. And it wouldn't be wasting my time, because they would already know who I am, what I struggle with. And then they could decide if they wanted to meet me or know more about me. And it, in a way, I kind of used it as a bit of a filter, not just with potential relationships, but with friendships, with who I am. And there's nothing I can do about it except shed a light on it and try to bring people together to find out how many people actually have this and have it as bad as I do, or well, and now that I did.
Wow, that's really amazing. And that clearly took so much courage to do that. And when you did decide to talk about it, was the response quite what you imagined it or anticipated it to be, or was it quite different?
I would say that I only had like a few kind of negative comments, but not really as many as I thought. The biggest gift that I've gotten from coming out about it was that a lot of people then turned to me to tell me their secrets, not related to BFRBs, but with a lot of serious issues. Like someone had told me about a family history of being molested and things like that. And I really saw it as a gift that people were trusting me with their secrets because I came out with my own, and it really put me in a different position in life to learn more about people and to empathize and understand. And I really still truly value that.
Absolutely. And you have yourself a skin picking support group, right?
Yes. And it's called Skin Picking Support. So
very easy.
As well as the website skinpickingsupport.com.
It's really easy for people to get to your website, and on your website you've got information, say if somebody wants to be part of this support group that you have, would they just reach out via your website?
Actually, the easiest way to get a hold of me is through Facebook. I mean, you can get a hold of me through skinpickingsupport.com, but we hold monthly meetings on Facebook through the group. And already I created it in October of last year, and we already have 1,300 members. That I did not expect. Wow. But I created it because I co-moderate Dermatillomania Awareness on Facebook and kind of have a few pages where I know what's going on. And I have seen a huge influx of people wanting to join. And it's not because of media articles. People are literally just searching it, doing an organic search in Facebook and coming across the groups. Like, we are being flooded with memberships. And it actually, a lot of it started during like the second wave. So probably about September-ish. Is when all of it happened. And I remember thinking, is there an influx of articles too? And there wasn't really. There was a few articles out there, but people were actually writing, like in the, we have questions to answer. People were saying, I searched it myself and I'm having this problem. And I realized that we had to, that something else had to be done about it. And I know that there's other support groups as well. But where I'm at, like there's really no support groups where the time zone meets up. So A, I can't attend any. But I also wanted to be able to create something that has monthly topics so that it's not always coming in and just talking about skin picking, how to stop, how to play with fidgets, I wanted to really delve into each kind of subtopic, like relationships for one of them, maybe medication for another one, how to deal with your family members or strangers and friends. So just a whole variety of questions and issues that we have to deal with, like how to cover up in the summer, maybe, or like there's so many aspects to living with this disorder that I felt need to actually be addressed and can really help people in what they're going through. Because unfortunately, as you know, skin picking is almost, when you have compulsive skin picking, it's a lifestyle, because some days are going to be worse than others and you're going to be a little more self-conscious. A lot of people, a lot of times, even now, like if I have something that once in a while I get some marks like around my eyebrows and here from scar tissue, as well as my chin, which unfortunately does not help with having to wear masks. They can flare up and I'm not as self-conscious, but I would still prefer to not have marks all over my face. It's especially hard though when I have to do things like go to the doctors, because I've been dealing with chronic pain now for 9 years. And when you go to the doctor, I'm just a nobody. I'm not anything famous. I'm just a gal from Nova Scotia. And if you're from around here, I'm a Dartmouth girl. And that that means, you know, we're just kind of chill. But I'm also viewed as less than because I don't have a career, unfortunately, because of my chronic pain. And I'm different from a lot of people. And I have had my chronic pain minimized so much. I've been ignored. I have been abused. I've I've had a lot of things happen in these last 9 years, and a lot of it has to do with being viewed as less than. And I also get the impression, even though no one has flat out said it, but there have been some, I guess, innuendos surrounding the validity of what I was saying with my chronic pain. And even with my pregnancy, I had a test that nobody else did. I was told that all new people had to take. And then when I saw new people come in, no one else was told to pee in a cup. So I don't know if they were testing for drugs. Wow. Or if they were actually testing to see if I was pregnant. There was another time I was having an attack with I also have like a fibroid on the left side of my body, and no one would deal with it when it was at its worst. And one time I had an attack that sent me to the hospital. And at this point I was in recovery and my skin was completely clear, but the doctor saw a mark around my bikini line and thought I had gonorrhea.
Oh.
And it's like, I'm not here for gonorrhea. I'm married. And then they lost the gonorrhea test at that. So trying to be taken seriously and trying to be seen for who I am. And even it doesn't matter how well I can articulate my pains or what's going on, I'm almost always viewed with like, oh, well, she has a strange mental health disorder. That was another one too. Like if I have this weird mental health disorder that I never heard of from their point of view, then there's something wrong with me. Mm. And I've been minimized so much over the years and ignored. And I had to go to the United States to get surgery after 6 years of agony. And in that sixth year, the pain transferred from my left piriformis muscle, which is in the butt, to my right hip. Well, it didn't transfer. It was both at the same time. And I was in a very dark place because I couldn't sit for those 6 years properly. I couldn't lie on my left side for those 6 years. And then when my right hip gave out, I couldn't do anything on that side either. And I was like, am I supposed to live like this for the rest of my life? And 2018 was quite dark for me in that regard. So I've had a lot of troublesome interactions with a lot of healthcare professionals, mental health and physical health, throughout my lifetime. Even before my chronic pain, I had people dismiss me about my skin picking. I had a duty doctor slap my hand when I was just sitting like this with my elbow on the table. And I had had the first time I had the infection on my chin, I actually write about it and show pictures in Forever Marked, and he didn't prescribe any antibiotics. And I remember I went home and I just went into my bed and just cried. And it wasn't a time that I even cried a lot in my life, but it just really pushed me over the edge that I was treated so inhumanely. And then not even treated at all, because it's hard to go to a doctor and say, look, I did this to myself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and he's like, are you happy with your life? And I was like, I don't even remember exactly how I responded. I was just like, I mean, obviously at that point I was like suicidal and stuff, and I was absolutely miserable just for the mental health component of what was going on and no understanding. It wasn't in the DSM-5, and it really is, like I said, a lifestyle to try to navigate the world looking the way we do especially when it's really flared up, and how other people can perceive you. And it's different when you come from, like I do, like, you know, a lower class background and don't have a lot of formal education. Like I had to drop out of university because of my mental health. And I ended up going back to college twice and ended up with a diploma the second time. But it's been a really rough go. And I know a lot of people with dermatillomania can relate to that, especially when it comes to healthcare professionals. And I don't have any stories about law enforcement or anything, because I haven't been around any sort of legal issues or troubles. But I can imagine that it would be the same, because A, when it comes to ER doctors and police, they deal with frontline transient communities. And if they see people with sores on their face, their first inclination is that you're an addict. And if you're an addict, that comes with such a heavy, heavy burden when it comes to getting treatment for anything, and when it comes to justice in the legal system. And I've been actually very, very curious. I have heard a few stories that have been so disheartening, but I want to know kind of more about the prevalence of other people's discrimination and learn more, because I learn so much from everybody else's stories, and it really helps me in kind of seeing the bigger picture of how this affects everybody.
Absolutely. And I guess that's those reasons are why many people don't come forward and talk to their medical professionals, or, you know, look at treatment options, because they are scared of being perceived as something completely different, or that they'll be ignored or abused. And I remember in your book Forever Marks, you mentioned how you'd spent months talking about your dermatillomania to a psychiatrist, and then you found out, I think it was like 6 months later, that they just passed it off as a phase and they didn't even write it down. And so
that was when I was in the child system.
Yeah. So like, and I know that you've been through quite a lot of different methods to try and understand like what works for you and to help you manage or cure your compulsive skin picking. And I think it's really important to like what you're doing to kind of collect those experiences of others so that you can see it from a we'll try and like decode it, I guess, and like analyze the current system or the past system and what can be implemented to benefit people within our community and really help people and stop that stigma, stop that prejudice. Because I've definitely spoken to people in the past where they do get called, you know, names, and people, you know, others kind of assume that they are doing drugs because they have visible marks on their face, on their hands, arms, and whatnot. And, that really puts a lot of people off taking that step forward and speaking to their medical professional, especially if, you know, they hear horror stories of going to these medical professionals and finding out that they don't really know anything about it, or they just brush you off. I've had a doctor brush me off before. He saw my marks and thought that they were moles, when they quite, you know, quite clearly weren't. And it's a shame, but
I think it's really important that you're saying this, is a lot of people who don't have skin picking or don't have any visible, I guess, flaws or whatever you want to call them, don't understand how hard it is even for people like us to leave the house when we're in the worst of our shame, when we've already kept it a secret for so long. To open up to anybody is almost like heart attack inducing. Like it is a huge deal to be able to say anything to anyone when you're in that state, because you're also admitting that you've done it to yourself and you don't understand why you've done it to yourself, and you're just looking for some help. And to have professionals act like God and then say, oh, this is what it is for sure, and it's like, no, it's not, I'm telling you what it is and I need help, and they're like, oh, it creates a distrust for the system, which I certainly have like strongly. And it makes it hard to gain access to a lot of things you have to, especially when doctors, sorry, I didn't want to fully interrupt you there, but it's just really important that you, I'm glad that you mentioned your experience.
No. Well, I think what you've just said is really important. you know, something has to be done, and raising the awareness and getting these conversations going, and strengthening that confidence and the trust within this community will hopefully help people, you know, put their foot down and kind of understand a lot more. It's unfortunate that a lot of people have to take measures into their own hands in terms of learning what they're struggling with. But, you know, hopefully over time that confidence will then get them in front of the right people. And if they do experience not a great service, then hopefully that'll still give them the confidence to push forward and try other options out there, or speaking with other medical professionals who may be a bit more inclined and a bit more, you know, have more experience in this as such. And so I know that you yourself have tried a lot of various methods over the years. And just for you personally, what has helped you in your dermatillomania journey?
Meeting Karen Pickett on an American TV show back in 2015. She's like one of the BFRB experts. I went into therapy a month after meeting her. We did it through video chat in 2015. My thing I said to her, I was like, you know, I have a really serious case, as you can tell, and I'm just going to do everything that you tell me to do. Just so I can say I did it, I didn't waste this opportunity, I'm going to do it. And if there's anything I learned from it, then cool, I'll probably end up just writing a blog post about it if it doesn't work. But if it actually works, then I could write a book. We could write a book together. Or I could at least write a book. And she agreed that she wanted together after that experience. Of course, we've had a lot of things go on, so we haven't been able to release it yet. But it's a therapy book, like a step-by-step guide for me, each week, kind of in diary style, talking about what we did each week from my perspective, and then her saying what she did each week, and then her opinion about how I'm like receiving the therapy. And I write down questions that I have, and it actually happened quite quickly. My face was clear within a month, but it took a long time for my legs to get clear. And I think it has something to do with the blood rush, or being, it's your legs are the furthest away from your heart. So it takes heal because of that really intense things. So what helped me the best, I mean, really came to the starter point, and it was the first few weeks of the therapy that really made the biggest shift. And then the stuff we learned later helped, I guess, more solidify my recovery. In the first 2 weeks, I did logging. First two, she extended it into 3 weeks. I did logging of my behaviors, of a CBT log that I don't have the exact thing on me right now to say what it said, but it was basically like, you know, when you pick, you have to write it down afterwards. So the first week, it wasn't about trying to intercept. It was about observing what was going on at the time and what was I doing? What's in my surroundings that could have triggered me? And what type of thoughts did I have that made me actually pick? And those are known as permission giving statements. So in the first week, it was about kind of just laying out what it was. Like every single time I picked, oh, it is the most tedious thing. I hate it so much. I hated it then. I hate it now. Because it really just does something. It's just like, oh, it's a form of like self-accountability as well as, because it's like there were times I was trying to trick myself, like if I don't pick, I don't have to write it down so that I didn't have to analyze any of it. And then, of course, that would be more anxiety. And so it was really a hard process to go through the therapy. So the second to third week, she expanded on that. And we ended up going into looking at more the statements and stuff, my permission giving statements. And then taking a look at what cognitive distortions were. And I actually value a lot of things like learning more about cognitive distortions versus fiddle toys. Like, I know a lot of people swear by fiddle toys and stuff, but I feel like you have to actually get down to the root issue. Like, what is it that you're telling yourself in that moment, identifying that moment, and being able to give yourself not just a competing response, which could include fiddle toys and whatnot, but you have to give yourself an answer to that question, that how to flip those statements to like, oh, I must pick my skin. It's like, no, I feel like I must pick my skin. And I would not have been able to do any of the cognitive distortion stuff until I did the logging, because the logging really slowed down my brain in to be able to recognize in the moment. Like, I was so focused on little things, like even trying to trick myself about not picking, so I didn't have to write it down. So it was quite a tedious part of it, and I was glad when the logging part was done. But then I noticed as I was logging that I would have to log less and less and less. And even if I did slip up, I was able to look back and be like, oh, I could have like said this instead with my permission giving statement to have avoided this. And it may not take away the urge or trigger that a lot of time is boom automatic, but it can definitely help in just, if something arises again, you have something new to tell yourself. And if you're able to convince yourself, which is what's really important, because I told Karen, I was like, I can't bullshit myself. I need to be able to tell myself things that are real. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't just say, oh, I don't want to pick anymore. It's just like, no, that's not true. I want to pick. it's in me to have to do that, or to feel like I have to do that. And so she's like, yeah, you do. And that's really important too. And she was just so supportive in ways that I've rarely ever had. I've only really had one mental health professional get me here where I live. She didn't know too much about picking, but when I met her when I was 19, my psychiatrist I had actually up until a few months ago when she retired, I really heard things just by accepting me, just by validating me and knowing how hard that struggle with the picking was, even if she couldn't do anything directly to intercept.
Wow.
There are like so many things, so many more things to therapy. Like, Karen's huge part of her therapy is acceptance commitment therapy. And I didn't really know too much about it at the time, but other than, you've got to accept yourself and oof. But it actually comes down to a bit of a contradiction between CBT versus ACT. I found that there was a contradiction, whereas CBT almost pathologizes conditions or can pathologize symptoms, but acceptance commitment therapy allows you to know and to be okay with the fact that we have uncomfortable feelings as the human experience, and that there's no such thing as a bad feeling. There are feelings that are uncomfortable. There are feelings that are awful to get through, but you can get through anything, and including skin picking urges. And you can do something, what a lot of people are calling riding the wave of a BFRB urge. And it's getting through that hard part where you're just trying absolutely anything that you can to not do it. And I remember at my first TLC conference that I went to, I saw Christina Pearson. I went to one of her seminars. And something that stuck with me is she said that when she was going into recovery, that she, during the worst of her urges, it didn't matter where she was, but what she would do was just drop to the floor. If she had an urge, just absolutely drop to the floor. I forget if she said if she like did this, but she dropped to the floor to get through it. To just,
wow, that's amazing. Wait, no matter where she was.
Yeah, wherever she was, she'd just drop wherever she was. If she, I mean, most of the time, if I find a lot of people get the urges more when they're by themselves, and like maybe it's in the bathroom, maybe it's when you're on your computer, and kind of when we're in our own little safe space and we're trying to process the daily events or what good events, bad events, just processing in general. Like,
yeah.
I mean, for me, skin picking, it wasn't just something I did when I was upset or sad, or it was something that I did like up to 8 hours a night when I was like really suicidal and whatnot. But once I came out with picking, I ended up by then doing it like maybe up to 2 hours a night.
Okay.
So it went from like sometimes as little as half an hour to 2 hours before I went into therapy with Karen. My legs were still full of marks and everything, and my legs have been clear ever since. And I still do get urges. I still struggle. I still have to go through the cognitive distortions, and sometimes it's really exhausting. But there's also times like when that are more stable in my life where I don't have urges hardly at all. Or if I do, I can be like I can see a pimple or something and be like, oh, well, that's raised. Okay. And then just walk away. And it's like, I could not do that before. I did not know how to walk away from anything, and I had gotten to a point where I stopped trying because my mantra was there's so many more, and I just keep getting triggered all the time. Okay, if I hold back on this urge, I'm just going to get triggered later, and I'm going to get triggered from this spot and that spot, and it was just too much to even try to begin to tackle. So having that professional help for sure is what changed the course of my skin picking. But I do believe that I'm going to have it for the rest of my life to some degree. And there's going to be things that already have happened since then. And there's going to be things that happen since then where I'm going to be more depressed or something. Like if there's a death in my family of someone important, like everyone loses their parents eventually and things like that. And I need to be more mindful that those situations are what's going to make my urges come out. Even if I don't realize, it's just all of a sudden, boom, as if it never went away.
Yeah. To be mindful of those and to kind of continue practicing the self-accepting kind of rituals that you've learned through the therapy. You've touched on great points, because what you said before about, you know, understanding that you may always be managing this is very good to know and good to hear, because I think a lot of people that I speak to, you can always tell when they're getting in touch straight after like an intense skin picking session, because that desperation, you know, like I need this to stop, like very self-critical, very pressurizing on themselves, and you know, like what can I do, tips to you know, sort these wounds out, these marks out, like very desperate. And and I definitely, us both, I'm sure, like definitely can relate to those moments. And I think for me, myself as well, I needed to kind of have that shift in my own mind of like, I'm not here to cure it. I'm not here to look for these quick wins and that's not going to stop something that I've spent, you know, 16 years doing. I need to kind of get to the root of the problem. And so like what you were saying earlier about the fidget toys and stuff, like I've tried many of them over the years, and you know, after a while I just put them down because they're not giving me that satisfaction the way the skin picking does. And so getting to the root of the problem, like what you said, you know, being able to go to support groups such as yours where you talk about things that can trigger your skin picking, whether it's like, you know, work stress or relationships or whatever, but also having a book like Embracing Dermatillomania, which is out soon. I think even though, like, again, you're using yourself as a case study, which is great, it's, I'm sure it'll be really helpful for other people because it will get their minds thinking about, you know, like I guess they would kind of be following along, right? Would that be kind of how you'd read it? You'd read it, you'd be the case study, but as a reader, they would be kind of mentally seeing themselves there with you also on that treatment journey.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And it's really important because it's like the change is gradual. It's not like I stop picking and then 5 days later, my face is healed, but it's just such incremental steps that lead to it. And that's what's really important. And I think it's also important for people to not expect that the urges will go away from therapy, even if there are times where, well, there will be times with successful therapy where the urges, the intensity of them will go down and the number of them will go down because you're retraining your brain to lessen all of that. And another thing that was important in my therapy too was to overall lower my baseline anxiety to be able to, so that I'm more calmer, so I can deal with the cognitive distortions easier instead of having that panic within of trying to, and then, oh no, just trying to rush it through your head. And things like simple things like, well, they're not simple because the anxious mind does not want to slow down. It does not want to stop, especially this one. And meditation and body scans are really important, even if they're just like 5 minutes, a few times a day, just to check in, and like deep breathing exercises, and it will slow down your baseline anxiety. And therefore it almost opens up a little bit more for you to be able to process everything and be able to make the better decisions. So my picking, it was like before, it was just a lot of it was, other than the intentional at the mirror stuff, a lot of it was just so automatic. And I wanted to just like, I would just be picking like this while I'm just doing anything. And it got to a point with my therapy where the picking went from being automatic to a choice. And for that shift to have gradually happened, like I said, it's not a choice. It's not even about willpower. Like a lot of people, and I'd wondered myself, do I just not have enough willpower to get over this? Like even as an advocate before my therapy. And I learned through therapy that no, it has nothing to do with willpower. It has to do with learning how to counter the responses in your head and to do like competing responses such as fiddle toys or putting up blockers or barriers, whether it's putting something on your fingers, whether it's putting a little Band-Aid on the triggering spot, that there's lots of things that you can do that all add up to the bigger picture of recovery.
Yeah, I think what you said about using like meditation and body scans as a way to kind of give yourself a mental crossroads, I guess, where you can go either one direction of skin picking, or you can go another direction of something else that's, you know, more positive in the long run for you. I've definitely experienced that with meditation as well. And I do think that, especially with meditation, it can be quite intimidating for those that haven't practiced it yet. The thought of sitting down and focusing on breathing, or like it can kind of be pushed off, you know, and say, oh yeah, you know, whatever. But I think also, you know, when you get past that initial stage of that discomfort and you're actually starting to feel the benefits long-term, when you realize that you're actually not as, you feel like you're not as stressed, like life can still be just as stressful, but how you're responding to the stressful events are, it can be completely different to like prior
to. There's definitely a different level of calm when when you start really engaging in it for a while. But I still personally hate doing it every time, and I don't do it as much as I should. I try to do, again, like the more little body scans and stuff, because it feels like it's unproductive. Like, of course, feelings are different from reality a lot of times, but it feels unproductive to just sit with yourself. You're not thinking of something, you're not trying to problem solve something, whether it's like how to get the baby's food made for tomorrow or just anything. It feels like you're wasting time, but it's really important, because I find that calmness almost almost slows down time because it slows down the way you process things, and it's like it can help you process. So you're definitely right. The benefits of it are great, but actually doing it is a bit of a pain. And then once you get into it, and then you can just kind of feel this calm or like a little bit of a peace where almost like your head stops. For me, it's like my head's always got stuff going on in it. It's always ticking. It's always spinning. But sometimes that can stop. And I don't think I had ever really had that before therapy. So all these things like really contribute to a new type of lifestyle and how to deal with urges.
Yeah. And it can be like discomfort, uncomfortable at first, if you're not used to pressing pause and feeling those feelings of calm, if you're not used to it, if you're constantly dealing with, you know, an overactive mind that's like stressing and worrying constantly and you kind of running on chronic stress, to press pause and have ways to just think of nothing and allow, you know, your mind to just kind of float there. That can be very unnerving. It can be quite, you know, uncomfortable for someone completely new to that, because you know, you're essentially putting these new measures in place that make you feel good and make you, you know, starting to kind of raise your self-esteem a little bit and your confidence, and these can all be really new feelings. And I know myself, I really struggled with that, even though it felt good. It's like it felt new, and with new, it was unknown. And so my mind was kind of, it was a real push and pull. Every time I was kind of making a bit of progress in that way, it was like, oh no, like the urge would like, you know, come quite high and try and pull me back. And, you know, it's just always trying to stay consistent with that, like, you know, steadily just doing the things that work for you to over time get you used to that new feeling and you know, allowing yourself to feel good and calm and not as stressed.
Yeah, I think it was particularly hard for me because I feel like my brain's been going like the way it does since I was a kid, really, for as long as I can remember. And since my picking started when I was little, like I have memories in grade one, grade two, it wasn't compulsive, but I had still like a bit of a fascination with scabs. And I have like just little memories like that. But then it got bad right before a traumatic event in grade five was when I started hiding my chest and my upper back. And of course, my face was also picked at. And I thought it was early acne. But and I knew I picked at it. But in what world is there like a skin picking disorder? And at that time, this is the 90s. And it just wasn't known to anyone, to doctors, to it just wasn't really a thing. So I felt so alone in it, and I felt so embarrassed as a kid. And I wasn't like bullied daily, but I definitely had people make comments about my appearance, and it kind of made me feel less than and solidified where I stood in society and amongst my peers. And that type of stuff has an effect on you, even as an adult, about how you present yourself and how others treat you. And it can be still pretty alienating even now, when my all I have left a lot of times is scars, to still just be treated in that different way. But it also makes you a lot of times carry yourself in a different way as well, maybe not be as open. Of course, I can only speak for myself, because other people, they can go out and be like, I don't give a flying F anymore about my, and like literally not give a, but I still like to kind of, I know I have turquoise hair, but still kind of blend in some ways and just not really be noticed and just go about my day normally. And that's really all I want. I just want to be treated like everybody else and just go about life without being bothered.
Yeah. And how have you found, since becoming a mother, how have you found your relationship with yourself? Have you found like it's evolved over time? Because I'm not a mother myself, but I can imagine, you know, it's just a completely new way of life.
It is. And it's actually a huge reason why I've gone back hard into my advocacy, because in having to deal with chronic pain for so long, and like I'm still waiting for hip surgery, even though my hip ripped 3 years ago now. But I had to make a decision in the small window I had. Do I try to get pregnant now, or do I not have kids at all? And it was only in a small window of time that I had to get pregnant, and I did. And I got pregnant twice, and unfortunately the first one didn't work out.
Sorry.
And then I was able to get pregnant again during the last month of trying, because my left hip started bugging me, and I was like, this is it, I can't do it anymore. And I felt like chronic pain had taken everything from me, and my advocacy had been dwindling, because being treated the way I was all the time, whenever I would see professionals, and still being quite insulated in my own home because of mobility issues, made it really hard. And putting myself out there wasn't really something I wanted to do. Deep down I did, but now I find, ever since I had my daughter, she's brought out like a new spark in me of wanting to do so much more and do so, be so much better. And like, I gave birth 5 weeks before the first lockdown. Wow. So there's so much in play. I had severe, I had hyperemesis gravidarum, where I was sick my entire pregnancy, and was even sick for 3 weeks afterwards. So I went from January of that year being super sick, to February giving birth, to March being locked down, to April finding out my mom had breast cancer during lockdown. And so 2020 was just a mess. Luckily, she's okay. She's had two surgeries and radiation, and it hasn't come back. Amazing. And I'm really, really thankful for that. And so by the time like October rolled around in September, and I saw like the influx of people, trying to join forums, I actually felt like I was in a better place mentally than I had been in years. And I really wanted to take advantage of that. While the rest of the world is like really struggling with the pandemic, you know, I was kind of, where I lived actually in Nova Scotia, we were considered one of the safest places in the world.
Oh, cool.
So we didn't really have much of a second wave. The next big wave we had only just ended now, and it was 40 days ish of isolation that I was just in. It ended a few weeks ago, but we really, when everyone was having that second, you know, people going back to school in September, and it just blew up. And I know the UK has blown up a few times.
Yeah.
We managed to like really stay safe until now. So I felt like I was almost at an advantage, like being the happiest I'd ever been in my life. And of course, so stressed and sleep deprivation from just my feedings, that you're so tired, you don't have the capacity to challenge those cognitive distortions. You just go, and you're almost like autopilot. And then if you just walk by the mirror and you go like this, and you look at the mirror and you see something, it's like it wasn't even a second thought. And I'm sure hormones played parts into it as well, but my picking has never been as bad as it was, certainly not in my late teens, early 20s, and definitely, and still not as bad as before therapy, even at my worst mentally, like 2018, when my pain really came to a head. So I feel really lucky that I haven't had a lucky life, but I've had certain things that have happened that have been such positive changes that I am so grateful for, and I really wanted to pay it forward with having a support group while people were struggling, not knowing how to deal with isolation. I'm like, hey, I've been isolating for years because of my picking, and then from there it was isolating because of my chronic pain. Mm-hmm. And then hey, I couldn't go outside I couldn't go into cars when I was sick with HG while pregnant. And then I was slowly going to, because I had planned on doing pool exercises for physio while pregnant, because my hip pain actually went away during pregnancy due to the hormone, but I was just so sick I couldn't do anything. So, and exercise is also a huge component to recovery, which unfortunately I've always kind of failed at because I've been in chronic pain for so long and incapable of doing a lot of things. But it's about also expending that nervous energy in you, and being physically involved is really important, because we now live in a society where we're in front of our screens and our brains are working more than our bodies. Our bodies are quite stationary. So to be able to get out and do something, and not just like do it under the sun, do it just being connected to nature is really important, being connected to the earth in that sense, and just getting your body moving. If it's just a short walk, if it's just even, I try now just to sit on my deck, even like my husband has to take my daughter for walks because I have a hard time getting out of our driveway because it needs to be redone, the pavement. But it's really important to just have that connection with nature and not be stuck inside and in your head. And so I really wanted with skin picking support to be able to pass on a lot of tips I've learned from therapy as well, and talk about those in-depth struggles that we have that a lot of people don't even think that we would have, but we do, because like whether it be self-conscious or like relationships or how to manage picking in school and so many different topics that are really important to, and like a lot of people have dealt with trauma. Not everybody has dealt with trauma. Mm-hmm. That has like been the onset of their picking, but I have a lot of trauma that which has kind of was revamped my picking almost a year to the date of my recovery. I had something happen to me in 2016 by a doctor that was very, very invasive. And it made me start picking again. And I went through 2 years of panic attacks, and to a point that I had never had in my life, where I was in the bathroom and I was literally hyperventilating, crying. I had to have the light turned off, and I was on the floor and sometimes I was throwing up. It was, and then I lost a lot of weight from that. So it was, those years were not good. And I'm so happy with everything I've gone through that I have a wonderful husband who's been there. He's cleaned out my barf buckets more often, more since like 2016 than between the pregnancy. And like, it's just, he's been so good and non-judgmental, and just how more like, what can I do to make this better, instead of I'm going to crap on her. Like I hear from a lot of people who have partners, and I think that's really important to delve into as well, because a lot of people have partners who don't understand and they're just hounding them. And the biggest thing is you get hounded by someone that you love and trust, you're not going to trust them that much, and your picking is going to be worse, like by far. If the person who's supposed to be like your anchor is belittling you or just doesn't understand, it's going to have a huge impact on how bad your picking is going to be, and it will make it worse.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, speaking from experience, my past couple partners, one of them I had to, this was years ago, had to pretend that I had a severe allergy to a detergent. I was thinking of every excuse under the sun, but you know, in hindsight, it was just red flags. I was in a really bad relationship. And obviously what was going on was presenting itself through these urges, you know, for me to self-soothe in this quite toxic environment. I've also been with someone who just really shrugged it off and saw it and said, you know, it's a habit, like just stop doing it. And like you said, it really does, that trust is in that moment, and from then on, it just doesn't really feel as close as it was before then. So I think it's so important to have someone that really has your back, and you can, you know, you feel completely yourself, free from judgment, and that you're able to have these conversations. And so as you've grown, as you've you know, been through all these experiences, good and bad. If you were in a room with your younger self, say like your 18, 19 year old self, or even before then, what would you say to them? What words of advice would you give them now?
Well, for sure by 18 was when I tried to end my life. And I would say that that Angie, you're not alone. There's other people who have this, who struggle with this, who have the same types of feelings you have, who feel alone, who feel unloved, who feel defective, who feel like a freak, who feel all these different horrible things, and they're not true. You're just a human who's going through a particular type of suffering, and that life can get better, and that life is hard, and there's going to be things that test it, and there's going to be things that dermatillomania will always kind of affect or spill into, but it doesn't have to define the way you live. It doesn't have to define your relationships. There are people who you can surround yourself with who even if they don't understand, they know that obviously you wouldn't be doing this no one wants to make marks on their body like that, like actual pick marks. Like, it's not like a deliberate self-harming act. And we're so frantic in trying to cover it up that for people to think that it's something we can just stop is just ridiculous. And it's compulsive skin picking. The word compulsive in itself is like details what it means and how we can't stop for some reason, for whatever reason that is. It becomes something, and it can happen at a young age. It can happen after a trauma. It can happen after just maybe a triggering event that just all of a sudden like activates something in you that causes you to start. And I think it's just really important for people to know that there's now especially so many different resources. There's TLC, there's the Canadian BFRB Support Network, there's Picking Me Foundation, there's various support groups that have been popping up online as well, especially during the pandemic, now that everything's transferred to being online. And really, there are people who understand, and finding that connection, finding that second family is so important, because we know the struggles. We can talk to each other without having to explain things in a certain way that other people you would have to go into more detail, but we just know. And that's what I noticed when I attended TLC conferences, like just how easy it is to talk to people as someone who's totally socially awkward. It's almost like they get me. They get the everything that's in my head, without even having to say anything. You can just kind of look at someone and you just know. And it's really comforting to know that, and to know that you're not alone in that.
Yeah, definitely, to feel seen and heard and understood, because this is a very well the majority that all of the bodily focus repetitive behaviors are very lonely, but as you said, you know, a lot of the time you're spent is, if you're not with dermatillomania, if you're not skin picking, it's then the cover-up, it's then, you know, trying to conceal it and desperately trying to heal the skin or undo what you've done, and it's a very lonely experience, especially if you're spending many hours of many days, weeks, months, years doing it. So you know, seeing this community build over the years is just remarkable, and you know, bit by bit, I think it's like, it's just so lovely, so rewarding and satisfying to see other people helping even more people to step up and get the conversations going within, you know, with their loved ones, their friends and family, and who they feel safe talking to. And it's, yeah, so important and so amazing to witness. And so lastly, I just wanted to ask if you have a specific quote that you like, if there's anything that resonates with you, a mantra or whatever.
Well, I have a few, but one of them that's always stuck with me, and I don't know how far you've gotten into my book. So, but because I use it there, is stand up for what you believe in, even if it means standing alone.
Wow. Absolutely.
And that's very important because I stood alone for so many years in not knowing it, that other people had this, that there was even a name for it. That, I mean, at the time there was no diagnosis. Doctors didn't know about it, most of them. And you've got to do what you feel is right in your heart. And for me, it was to finally come out and to shed myself of that shame, or at least begin that process of just saying, if you don't like this, then kind of screw you type deal. I mean, when you're talking about your past relationships, having skin picking or BFRB is almost a great social filter, because you get to really, really knock out a lot of those toxic influences in your life of people who are judging you, who are questioning you, who aren't even trying to understand you,
totally.
Who are constantly on your back about it. And it's like, do you not understand what my experience is yet? Like, and it's made my life, I think it's enriched it to have found someone like that, and to have friends like that, and to even have in-laws who totally understand and support my advocacy. Like, I feel like I am in a position where I'm completely supported by my inner circle, and it's really, really great. And it has a profound effect on my life because I don't have to hide who I am. I can still just like go to my in-laws' house with like the bandages on my face or whatever, if I'm having a triggering spot or if I've already picked at something, and they're not going to ask questions. They're not going to berate me. It's just, it is what it is. It's like, oh, cool. She has this. And I think that that's how we should be handling hearing about anybody's struggles or anybody's secrets, even if we can't understand them, to just be there with that person and say, I'm sorry that you're going through this or have had to endure this. And I can't imagine that would be incredibly difficult, and just be there instead of criticize or well, maybe you should do things this way or that whole trying to give advice thing that we all get as skin pickers when people try to give us skin advice or anything like that, like unsolicited. And it's like, no, we just want to be who we are. We don't want our appearance to be commented on. We don't want our behaviors to be commented on. We just want to get through our days. Mm-hmm. We as just another human being that's worthy of love and acceptance and friendship.
Totally. I think that's just, yeah. I can't put it in any words as well as that. So yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Angela. It's been so like amazing to talk with you. And so just to wrap up, if anybody wants to purchase Forever Marked, a Dermatillomania diary, that is on Amazon. Are there any other areas other than Amazon, or is that the best place for people to check it out?
Amazon's a good place. It's also available on Kindle as well. And same with Scars of Shame. That's on Amazon as well and through eBay currently. So I have a lot of plans in the future now. Again, having my daughter has just like sparked so many different things, and seeing other people do things online, including yourself, like the things you've been doing are quite just like out there. And I'm like, boom, I'm not going to be out there like a Kim in her way. I'm going to do Angie my way. And everyone has their own little way of doing things, but it also challenges you to kind of push yourself to do other things, to do more things, to, you know, because we're constantly evolving, and we evolve based on who we surround ourselves with. Yeah. And that includes the media that we intake, which for sure includes the social media that we have. And it's really important to follow pages like that have to do with skin picking or BFRBs, because when your newsfeed is inundated with people who have imperfect skin, it does have that effect on you of normalizing
yeah.
normal skin. Totally. And it's very important. And I'm so happy to have been able to speak with you. And you're doing such great things, Kim. And I hope that you're able to evolve as well and learn more the more you speak to people about stories and get involved in the community. And it does wonderful things. And I can see you going really far with this.
Thank you so much. That's really, really kind. And so if anybody wants to reach out to you, what's your social handles? Just if anybody does want to reach out to you on social media after this.
Angela Hartland. And I also have one on Instagram for the Skin Picking Support Facebook group, which is called Skin Picking Support. So you can find me in either handles.
Perfect. Well, once again, thank you so much, Angie. It's been so lovely to talk to you, and I wish you all the very, very best. I'm sure we'll chat again very soon.
For sure.